Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies. You can study a variety of topics such as creative writing, human rights, and the arts. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What allows a particular work of fiction to resonate with multiple generations of readers? With more than 80 million copies of her books in print in 31 languages, Judy Blume's bibliography includes not only a crop of best-selling classics, but also a number of works on the American Library Association's most challenged book list. And yes, some of them appear on both lists. The youngest readers come to Blume's work for its relatable humor and unforgettable characters like Fudge, and stay with her as they grow for her honest depictions of adolescent sexuality, class conflict, and family struggle. This year, Blume is celebrating the 40th anniversary of her kids' novel Tales of a Fourth Grade Nothing, and she's in town for the DMA's Arts and Letters Live series. Her appearance takes place this evening at the First United Methodist Church in Dallas. Judy, welcome to Think.
Thank you.
I think the thing that drew me to your work as a kid is the same thing that keeps my own kids reading your books, which is that they are written as if children have written them. They sound like kids and not like children who've been filtered through some kind of adult moral. Did you look around when you first started writing and realize that that was missing?
I have no idea. I don't know how it worked or why it worked. I'm just grateful that it did and that it seems to still be working. I wish I could explain how it happens. I've always connected with kids. Even now, I'll look at a four-year-old and she'll look at me and there'll be a connection.
And I would imagine people watching is still something that you have to do.
I love it. Mm-hmm. I love it. And people listening. Yeah.
Yeah. Is the dialogue really different today than it was when you started?
Well, I don't know. That's a good question. I'm still writing, and I don't really think about it in terms of being different. I stay away from, you know, what's very in today,
yeah,
or what was very in then, and just try and, I don't know, try and just keep it timeless. But I don't really think about that when I'm writing.
The other thing about your books is that I think it's not just a matter of respecting kids' intelligence. You respect the depth of their emotions and the kinds of things they think about. You know, everybody remembers Margaret and her first period and all that, but she's also dealing with, like, her religious identity, which is something that we used to assume only adults thought about.
Well, I love kids, and I remember being a kid, and I know the kinds of things that I was thinking about and worrying about. I was anxious. Mm-hmm. And the things that I worried about were my father's health and well-being. When I was 9 years old, I believed that it was up to me to keep him safe because two of his brothers had died at 43 and he was 43. Mm. What a burden.
Yeah.
You know, I never shared that with anyone. Never told anyone about it. I wrote about it a little bit in starring Sally J. Friedman as herself and making bargains with God, who was my confidant also in Margaret. But kids think about things, the same kinds of things that adults think about. And it's scarier for them.
It's funny that there almost seems to be this pact between children and their parents that they're each protecting the other.
Isn't that the truth? Mm-hmm. That's really it. Yeah. And what a shame. Always trying to, I can remember trying to, my mother wanted me to be happy. Be happy. Be happy. That's what she wanted for me. And so I pretended, you know, and I was good at pretending. And I never shared with my parents what was really inside me. And I think you just hit it exactly on the spot. I've never heard anyone say that before, and it's so true.
When you were a child, did you think about writing as something you could do with the rest of your life?
I never thought about writing, no. But I always, always had stories inside my head. Always. And the way I played my kind of play, whether it was bouncing a ball against the side of the house or playing long after some people think I should have with paper dolls that I made myself. It was all drama, heavy drama, heavier drama than I ever wrote about. But the stories were there inside my head always.
Was humor a big part of the family you grew up in?
Yes. My father had a wonderful sense of humor, was the toastmaster at all the dental association meetings, a great teller of stories and a great teller of jokes. And yes, I think that my humor came from my father.
Being someone who connected so well with kids and had this great imagination, when you had your own children, did it seem like a huge burden to connect with them in this way? And did you sort of start parenthood with particular expectations?
I was way too young and inexperienced and naive when I had my kids. You know, and I'll say I was 23 and 25, but really my life experiences were so limited at that time. I always knew I wanted children. I always knew that. But what did you ask me
Just what your expectations were in terms of connecting with your own kids and maybe understanding them in a way that you hadn't wanted your parents to fully understand you.
Well, I did want to. I mean, I definitely, you know, I said, my children are going to be able to come and ask me anything. I'm going to tell my children whatever they want to know. And, you know, all of these wonderful things that it doesn't always happen that way. Yeah, I wanted to be the best mother in the world. And to a lot of my readers, I mean, that's really funny because they say, oh, if only you had been my mother, life would have been fine. And I say, look, you know, I did the best I could do. I made a million mistakes. We all do. If you ask my kids, they would tell you the truth. You know, I love them, but I wasn't the perfect mother. Mm-hmm. Who is?
Your kids were in, I guess, junior high and high school when you divorced. That it must have been hard to sort of shepherd them through that.
They were 12 and 14. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And it's always a really tough time. I don't think I knew how difficult a time it would be. I thought, we can do this. We're going to be fine doing this. And of course, we've all come out of it fine, and everyone is happy, and I'm very friendly with my former husband and his wife, who's a lovely woman, and that's good. But it was very, very painful. It was very hard. And it was lonely. It was sad.
There is a loneliness to a lot of your characters, and there's this bravado as well, but there's also the sense, I remember as a kid connecting with a lot of your characters because they, like me, were the only ones who knew that they didn't quite fit in.
There's always that, you know, I'm the only one, surely nobody else is like me, and I'm never going to confide and let anybody else know who I really am. I want to be like everyone else. I want, like Margaret, I want to be normal. Whatever normal is, whatever a child sees as normal, but it's almost never what that child is. So, yeah, I mean, I would tell you that I had a basically, very pleasant and happy time growing up. I felt loved. I felt accepted. But, oh, yes, I was lonely being me, even though I had friends, because I thought maybe I was the only one.
So now as you write, you must be aware that there are people who will come to your work almost regardless of the subject, regardless of the character, because they have come to trust you. Does that change the way you go into the project?
It would be very dangerous to me as a writer, or to anyone as a writer, to take that kind of responsibility into the little room where you work. Responsibility, yes. I mean, I've always felt responsible to do the best I can do. I'm a conscientious girl, an eczema girl.
A rule follower. Are you a rule follower or a rule breaker?
That's really interesting. In real life, my husband would tell you, Judy is a rule follower. In writing, the other side of me comes out. And I never think about rules. And I guess I've broken them all. So I'm, a good girl and a fearful person in many ways, but not when it comes to my writing.
So at this point, when you end up banned by some school district in some small place, I suppose you've gotten used to it. But the first time that happened, when you were still establishing yourself, what did that feel like?
You never get used to it. I just have to tell you that the other night in Houston at dinner, I was seated next to a wonderful librarian who fought valiantly to keep one of my books on her library shelf. And three committees said, yes, we vote to keep this book. We vote to retain this book. And then the school superintendent came in and said, I'm taking it out. Hmm. I mean, that's tough. And now I feel for the librarians and the teachers and the parents and the kids who fight to keep the books there. Those are the people. I mean, they're the ones who are really out there doing the work. What did it feel like the first time? Remember, it. I started to write really in the early 70s, mm-hmm. and it didn't happen in the 70s. 70s was a good, a very good period for a lot of writers who started out writing children's books. It was a decade when editors were not afraid to take a chance. And then the 80s came, and everything changed. And the first time I heard about it, well, it was my children's elementary school. Hmm. And it was a male principal who decided that the three copies I had given to the school library of Are You There, God? It's Me, Margaret, proudly, you know. He decided that they could not be there because of a discussion of menstruation, as if to say, all those kids who had their periods in fifth and sixth mm-hmm. grade, you know, to deny them the right to read about it, or all the kids who were looking forward to it, and all the boys who wanted to know about it. I've been hearing lately from a lot of men saying that they grew up reading the books about the girls to find out about girls, real girls. I love that.
It must have been astonishing when it was your kids' own school. I mean, were you angry? Were you? Was it insulting?
Yes, it was. I was angry. I was. I didn't know what to do, and for a long time, I didn't know what to do, and for a long time, I felt alone in this battle. And then I met up with the National Coalition Against Censorship, and I found a way to work with them on behalf of not just my books, but all the other authors whose work was being challenged and sometimes banned. And, you know, to fight for the kids, because as always, they're the big losers, right?
And they're not usually given a say in what gets banned or censored. They're just told that this is okay and that's not okay.
Which only makes them want to read it more.
Yeah.
Why isn't it okay? What's in this book? And I've had so many letters from kids. Like, I read your book, Dini, to find out what was bad in it, and I couldn't find it.
My guest is award-winning author Judy Blume. She's celebrating the 40th anniversary of her book, Tales of a Fourth Grade Nothing, this year. And she's in town to speak tonight at First United Methodist Church in Dallas for the Dallas Museum of Arts, Arts and Letters Live. The talk begins at 7 o'clock. If you would like to join our conversation, we have phone lines open at 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a multidisciplinary program that allows you the intellectual freedom to design your own master's degree. More at smu.edu/MLS.
Yeah. You're listening to Thank Gone, KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Award-winning author Judy Blume is celebrating the 40th anniversary of her book, Tales of a Fourth Grade Nothing, this year. She's in town to speak tonight at 7 at First United Methodist Church in Dallas for the Dallas Museum of Arts Arts and Letters Live Series. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, give us a call at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Judy, something that I've always wondered about, and you surely have perspective on this, is why people who are concerned about the ideas introduced to children go to very great lengths to ban certain books and reading material, but don't seem to be bothered by the movies and the TV shows and the other forms of media that kids are exposed to.
I can't explain it. I mean, I think a lot of it grows out of fear and the desire to control your children's lives, what they're thinking. Of course, you can't do that. But some people think, if they don't read about it, they won't know about it. If they don't know about it, it won't happen to them. And certainly, it will mean that they won't come to their parents asking them questions that their parents might not want to answer.
Yeah, those questions can be uncomfortable.
They can be. Yes, I heard a wonderful story, again, from a librarian. I was with a lot of librarians at the Texas Library Association. And one told me a story I'd never heard before, which is that her little boy was reading Tales of a Fourth Grade Nothing. I guess it was Super Fudge. Mm-hmm. It was a Fudge book on his own. And he came in and he said, "Mom, Fudge has a question. And I have the same question. Where do babies come from?"
Hmm. And obviously, as a librarian, was she open to the question and loved that it was introduced by literature?
I think that she did. Mm-hmm. I mean, and it's a great way to start a conversation. You know, kids don't need long, involved answers. When they ask a question, simple answers to the point. That's all that they want. And sometimes they read a book and they don't even know that they have a question, because if they don't get something, they read right over it. And that's another reason why I hope that, you know, parents can be more relaxed about what they're reading. If they come with a question, be ready. If they read right over it, fine.
Don't make a big deal about it.
Right.
You know, I'm 41 and I joke that I'm still not allowed to read forever. But in truth,
I'm giving you permission right now. You're old enough.
Well, in truth, my parents, TV was limited. Movies were limited. But if we were reading, nobody ever even asked what it was. They were delighted and figured that we were learning something useful. Were there times when you, not to censor them, but did you read along with your kids? Did you want to know what ideas they were being introduced to?
I loved sharing books with them, and I loved reading the books that they were reading, and I think that's always a good idea. Another librarian that I know and I've known for a very, very long time had a wonderful program that she started herself, and she never had a censorship issue while she was teaching. She had a parent group that came to school in the evenings, and she introduced them to a lot of the books that their kids might be reading that year. And they talked about it. And that was so great. And it eased the parents' concerns. I'm not just talking about my books. You know, I don't think my books are that controversial. Certainly in today's world, I don't think they're that controversial. But to know what they're reading, whether or not they want to talk to you about it. And I think as they get a little bit older, they don't want to talk about everything, and they shouldn't have to. And some books are private experiences. Just let them read. Don't be judgmental. Try, anyway, not to be judgmental, because reading is good, whether they're reading graphic novels or comic books or adult fiction or nonfiction, whatever they're reading. That's great. You know, reading should be rewarded. I always say in my house growing up, reading was a very good thing. And yet my parents didn't know what I was reading, and I don't think they were concerned what I was reading. I was reading off the bookshelves at 12, you know, their collections of books. And that was great. There were no YA books when I was growing up. So I went from kids' books, from Maude Hart Lovelace and Betsy Tacy, to adult books at 12. And it was wonderful. It made me love reading. I didn't know half of what was in those books, but there was something, some secret into the, some clue into the adult world that I was so interested in, because secrets, I think that's such a hard part of being a kid, the secrets that adults are always trying to keep from you. What are these secrets?
Yeah, have you ever gone back, I have done this, and read a book that I know I read at 10 or 12 or 14 and thought, I wonder if I got that the first time I read it, because I don't remember something about a book. Mm-hmm.
A lot of people say that about Margaret, that they go back and read it and they realize this book is not about menstruation and breast development. This book is about a kid who is trying, she's grappling with, you know, ideas of religion and God, and they didn't really get that as a kid, but they didn't remember that that's what they were getting.
Did you read the Chuck Palahniuk book that was based on Margaret?
A little bit of it, yes.
Very different approach, certainly.
Well, you know, it's like, what is Chelsea Handler?
Yeah.
Are you there, vodka? It's me, Chelsea. I mean, that, you know, everybody uses that now. At first, I thought, no fair, that's mine, but now I'm honored.
What about, what does it take to get in the mind of a male protagonist and in the voice of a male protagonist? Certainly Tales of a Fourth Grade Nothing, Then Again, Maybe I Won't. Is it different for you somehow?
I don't think it's different. I think, you know, it takes some time to find the voice when you're writing. I mean, that's the most difficult part of it. It can take months of scribbling. I remember when I was writing Wifey, it took forever to find Sandy's voice so that I could tell the story, even if it's not in first person. Mm-hmm. You need to be able to find the voice. With Tony in Then Again, Maybe I Won't, I had been a 12-year-old girl writing Margaret. You know, I mean, I was a woman, but I writing in the voice of a 12-year-old girl. Yeah. And when I finished that, I thought, now I want to be a 12-year-old boy. And somehow, you know, I mean, my kids were little, so it wasn't that I had a son and I could hear his voice in this. I don't know. I have no idea how it happened. And I do know in Summer Sisters, until I let the men have voice, the book didn't work.
What is the rewriting process like for you?
Heaven. Heaven. Just don't ask me what the first draft is like, because the first draft is pure torture. I hate it. And when kids say to me, what's your secret power? The secret power that I want is that, you know, it will just come out and it will be there on a page and I'll be able to then start the process. That's the real writing process for me, the process that I love and keeps me writing, which is the rewriting, the second, third, fourth, fifth, with Summer Sisters, 23 drafts.
23 drafts,
23
really.
Drafts to get it right. It was a painful, long haul to get that book right. Yeah.
Was there a point at, you know, 15, 16 when you thought maybe this is not going to come together?
No, it was earlier on. Mm-hmm. Earlier on. In the process. And then suddenly, again, it was, you know, letting the men jump in and speak, men of all ages, just little paragraphs, but giving them a voice.
Was Wifey your first adult novel?
It was, yes.
Were you concerned that people would think, well, this woman writes for children, and did you worry about the response?
You know, worrier that I am, I did not worry about that. Yeah. I again, when it comes to writing, it was like, look, I'm an adult woman and I have other experiences and feelings that I would love to get out there. And I did it.
A lot of authors who have multiple novels published don't have, you know, dozens of them in print at the same time, which you still do. It's got to be odd to meet people on a regular basis who have just come to these characters for the very first time.
Oh, that's fun. That's kids. Mm-hmm. You know, they've just met them. I mean, they don't believe it when I'm at a book signing and there are adults in line. It's like, what are you doing here?
Hmm.
These are my books. But of course, now what's happening is that parents want to share the books that they grew up with their children. This is dangerous. And I warn parents, it's wonderful. And when you have young children, it's easier to share the books that you love. You can, you can lie in the bed together and read Tales of a Fourth Grade Nothing, any of the Fudge books. I have some younger books too. But when they're a little bit older, if you force them, I want you to love these books the way I
yeah.
did, you are so going to turn them off.
Mm-hmm.
And so my latest, I've come up with this idea, my latest is if you can possibly afford to buy a paperback with a new cover or ebooks. They're all available now as ebooks. And if your kid thinks that's cool, leave them around the house. Don't say you've got to read this and love this because I did. And every now and then say, no, you're not ready for that.
Hmm. I know that you narrate your audiobooks yourself. Is that right?
Only the Fudge books.
Oh, okay. Okay.
And I think I did starring Sally J. Friedman as herself.
Well,
I hate my voice.
Do you really?
Yes.
Well, they read aloud so beautifully, and I'm wondering if it's something that you're always aware of, that it, particularly your works for, you know, middle grade and younger readers may be read aloud.
Well, I love audiobooks, mm-hmm. and I was thrilled to be asked to be the reader for the Fudge books. And the first time I was in the studio reading, and again, I had no experience, and I was reading along, and the engineer kept knocking on the glass, saying, no, you skipped that. No, you changed that. And I said, well, I know, but I'm making it better.
So you were editing.
yes. And a very important lesson came from that. And I always knew to do this. Read your books aloud to yourself before they're published, because you don't get another chance after.
Because it's sort of down. Once it's in print, you can't. Even you, Judy Blume, can't change it.
I can't go into the recording room and change it. No.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We're speaking this hour with author Judy Blume, who's in town to speak at Arts and Letters Live tonight. Let's go now to Tom in Arlington. Hello, Tom.
Hi. I'm a newly published speculative fiction writer, and you know, all my friends are now trying to move over into the young adult, the YA genre. And I love to write about and read about children and teenagers, but I would like to write about them realistically, the way they actually behave, which does not usually get you classified as YA literature. It's a little bit too much. I don't want to be deliberately profane, but I just don't think children and teenagers act the way they're portrayed in those kinds of books. They're more like Fast Times at Ridgemont High or Game of Thrones is the way George R. R. Martin writes about teenagers. So how do you get away with that? How do you get editors and publishers to look at your stuff and the YA market and yet not feel like that you have to launder everything to be in that market?
Huh. Well, I was with John Green the other night, and he is the perfect example of a wonderful writer who writes YA fiction about real kids in the real world. And so it's not true that everything has to be dystopian or vampire-ish or kids killing kids. A good book is a good book, and I think editors are always looking for a fresh voice. And so you go with what you feel comes naturally, and don't worry about the marketplace. The marketplace is cyclical. You know, vampires come and go, and I'm not knocking vampires. They're not my thing, but it's okay. I'm not biting them. But you have to write what's inside you and write from the guts and the heart and do it as well as you can. And if you need some inspiration, there are a lot of great books out there, and you can start with John Green.
Do your reading habits change when you are in the middle of a book?
Yeah, they change to like less than zero.
Mm-hmm.
It's very, very hard for me to read fiction when I'm writing fiction, because I like to get involved in the books that I'm reading. A good book,
yeah.
I'm involved and I'm thinking about the characters. I can't afford to do that when I have to be totally thinking about my characters. I can read other things. I can read short things. I can read something totally different than what I'm working on. But for inspiration, I need to do that more between books.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also email think@kera.org. We have one here from Matt in Plano who writes, I have fond memories of reading Tales of a Fourth Grade Nothing, and now I'm a father of two beautiful little ladies, ages 3 and 6. My question is, at what age would you recommend the reading of this book?
Well, you can certainly read it to a 6-year-old. You can read to any age, because what reading is about, as much as the story, is about that warm feeling of dad is reading to me, and I love it. I love the sound of his voice, or mom and her voice. But I do have, I'm not here to push books, but I do have a series of 4 books based on characters called The Pain and the Great One, and they're little chapter books, and I'm very fond of them. And they are, I would say, pre-fudge. So pre-fudge, you could read the Pain and the Great One books. And then I would, fudge is definitely 6-year-old. A 6-year-old with a 3-year-old little sibling, perfect. And even the 3-year-old will get a kick out of it, I think.
Yeah, there's a lot to relate to, certainly, if they can understand those relationships to begin with. My guest is award-winning author Judy Blume. She is this year celebrating the 40th anniversary of her book, Tales of a Fourth Grade Nothing. She's in town to speak tonight at 7 at First United Methodist Church in Dallas to the Dallas Museum of Art's Arts and Letters Live Series. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, we have lines open at 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a graduate education flexible enough to allow you to explore what matters most to you. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with author Judy Blume. It's been 40 years since the initial publication of Tales of a Fourth Grade Nothing. Blume is in town to speak tonight at First United Methodist Church in Dallas to the Dallas Museum of Art's Arts and Letters Live Series. You can join this conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. So you have a son who is a filmmaker and is actually directing the movie version of Tiger Eyes. Is this the first time Tiger Eyes has been made into a movie?
It's the first time any of them have been made into a feature film. Yes.
Wow.
It's very exciting. Yes. And, of course, this son, Larry, was the original inspiration for Fudge, the character of Fudge, who did all of those things when he was 2, except he didn't swallow a you-know-what. And but we always said, he's an interesting baby, an interesting toddler. And he grew up to be an interesting man. And, for mother and son to work together side by side, we wrote the screenplay together. And I was at his side, although I was very quiet because I know, the director is it. But he was very generous on the set. And I was there all 23 days. And I loved every second of it. It was so exciting. It was a real thrill.
That must be an interesting way to experience a relationship with your son, even as well as you've known him over the years. It's a different dynamic when you're working together as professionals.
Yeah, I love that. I said to my husband the other night after Larry and I were presenting at one of the film festivals, and I came home and I said to my husband, who is Larry's stepfather, He's such a man now. You know, he's a man. I mean, he's not my little boy at all. He's a grown-up man, and it's a different relationship. And we seem to be able to separate the parent-child relationship when we're working.
Mm-hmm.
Other times, we sink back into it, but it was a thrill and something I'll always remember, and I know he will too.
Do you think the experience of being a parent has changed more over the past 40 years than the experience of being a child?
I don't think the experience of being a child has changed. I think that's something that's universal. I mean, the world around children changes, but children don't change. Parents, I mean, again, that's cyclical. What's in? How do we raise our children? Changes from generation to generation. I don't know that the feelings about it change, but certainly, you know, I watched my daughter raise a child, and it was like, oh, what are you doing? What would you like for dinner tonight? Just put dinner on the table.
Would you like to eat it or not, or eat nothing?
Right. Yes. Or have the cereal poured over your head like in Tales of a Fourth Grade Nothing.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go to Amelia in Fort Worth. Hi, Amelia.
Hi.
Hi, Amelia.
Hi. Well, I just was calling because growing up in a conservative homeschool environment, we didn't really talk about things in my family. So we went to church, and that was about it. We didn't talk about God or periods or anything. So when I was 11 or 12 and reading Are You There, God? It's Me, Margaret, I remember feeling like we don't talk about these things and feeling like it was something that was I shouldn't be reading because it was taboo, I guess, which is kind of silly because they're universal topics, but I was just wondering, do you often hear of other young readers feeling as though they're being parented by books like about Margaret?
I have never felt that I'm parenting any child by writing a book. That's not my job. Some kids, grown-ups, have told me that when they were children, their parents didn't talk to them about anything. And so, you know, reading a book, maybe one of my books, help them. I'm not getting that from you, but I think if a child picks up a book and feels uncomfortable with it, put it down. This isn't a book that you have to read. In fact, I'm surprised you got your hands on that book. I'd love to know how you did.
Yeah, it doesn't seem like maybe the first choice of homeschooling very conservative parents, like if I'm getting Amelia's description right of her family.
Right. And, you know, if your family doesn't want to talk about certain things and you don't either, well, that's fine, too.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We'll go next to Bob in Fort Worth. Hey, Bob.
Good afternoon, Ms. Bloom. How are you today?
I'm good. Thank you.
Hey, listen, recently I was on the internet, had a lot of time, nothing to do, and I want a list of famous people from New Jersey. Your name came up, and you were born in Elizabeth, New Jersey.
I certainly was.
I went to school in Elizabeth, New Jersey. Went to Catholic school, Immaculate Conception. I had friends there. And growing up there are a lot of strong personalities there, you have to admit. I was wondering if there are any characters, and I was a substitute teacher, and kids love your books. I was a kindergarten substitute teacher in kindergarten. Kids really like your books. That was here in Keller. I was wondering if any characters that you grew up with, there were characters that inspired some of the people you grew up around or anything like that.
You know, that's really interesting. I'm glad you asked that because it just happens that the book that I'm writing right now takes place in Elizabeth, New Jersey in 1952. And when people say to me, oh, you mean you're writing an historical novel? I say, no. That's when I was in junior high school. It's not historical. When you write fiction, You know, characters are composites of many people you've known, you've heard, you've seen on the street. So, my most autobiographical book is starring Sally J. Friedman as herself. That's really the kind of kid I was and more or less my family. But this book, of course, has, because it's based on true events that happened in Elizabeth, there may be more of that. Although my viewpoint characters are all invented characters. You do go back. You know, my past is very, very clear to me. And that time was something that I never forgot. It's funny that I never thought about writing it until recently. And it just came out. It's like, oh my, I have this story and I've got to tell this story.
It does seem like you must have a unique sort of memory, because a lot of us can imagine ourselves at a particular age and remember some of the experiences, but to be able to fall into the language and the cadence and the reality of being that age is a very different thing. Reading to my own kids, your books and Beverly Cleary's books are the ones that it's just so clear that you know exactly what's in the heads of these kids.
Beverly Cleary was my inspiration when I started to write. I adore Beverly Cleary. She just celebrated her 96th birthday.
It is remarkable.
I hope she has many more. And I can't tell you how many people on Twitter say, oh, Judy, I loved your Ramona books. And I say, you know what? I love them too. And thank Beverly Cleary for them. They get Ramona and Fudge, you know,
yeah.
They get it confused.
I could see those two stirring up trouble together.
But when I went to the library, when I started to write and brought home armloads of books, it was Beverly Cleary. Her books, just, I fell off the sofa laughing. Mm-hmm. And it was like, I want to write books like these.
Yeah, and it's never at the expense of the people who are making you laugh. You're sort of laughing because you can imagine yourself in the same place.
Yes, yes. She's wonderful.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We have Ben on the line now in Dallas. Hi, Ben.
Hi. Yes, I have a couple of children in school, a couple of daughters, and I was wondering, since you had your book censored, you know, the topic of you've got God and religion in some of your books, and those books start conversations with the kids, and it seems like it gets the teachers nervous or uncomfortable. How have you addressed the issue of just being allowed to have the topic of God and religion in books, and because there's a big push right now to, you know, trying to censor that out of the public schools, you know, the Bible and things like that. How do you address people that have a problem with that?
Well, of course, when I wrote Are You There, God? It's Me, Margaret, I was just writing about my own private relationship with God. God as my friend, the person that I could go to and talk to at night. And so I never thought of the book as being assigned reading in school. I've never heard of it being assigned reading in school. I don't think it's a book that teachers read aloud in school. And all of that is fine and good because it's a private, you know, some books just need to be private between the reader and the characters in the book. And not every book needs to be the subject of a book report or, you know, the subject of teachers' questions. So I've never really heard about that, I can't say.
What do you think about the book report as this venerated institution of making sure that kids have paid attention to what they read?
I was a very bad, and I tell children, after I told you I was a good girl, mm-hmm. actually in sixth grade, the books that I was actually reading, I didn't want to write book reports about. And so what I did was I invented books. And
no kidding.
Yes, I did. And I invented an author and a theme and characters. And I would stand up and give a book report, an oral book report. And I always got an A on those. And when I actually read the book, I didn't always get an A. But that may be, you know, one of the worst things I ever did in school.
Well, and no one was the wiser. I guess your teachers didn't discover that these were not real books?
No, she didn't. And maybe she did, but she thought it was interesting. I really don't think she did, because what I was reporting on were horse books, because mm-hmm. I thought that's what I was supposed to be reading, Dobbin and this and Dobbin and that. And I tell kids this story, and I tell teachers this story, and I tell kids that your teachers are much more tuned in today to books that are available. And probably you shouldn't do that, but I tell the teachers, why not once a year let the kids have a pretend book report? Wouldn't that be fun?
Yeah, it's a great window into what they're really thinking about and what they want to be reading. Do you actually hear, Judy, from the people who don't approve of your books? Do they will they come up to you at a conference and say, here's what I don't like, or do they sort of snark from a distance?
It's more from a distance, mm-hmm. I would say. It's not always directed at me. Sometimes the publisher will get nasty letters. I like to see what's out there. I mean, I like them to share it with me. And sometimes now I will answer a thoughtful email or a letter from a parent who is concerned and upset. I will not answer one that's just, telling me what a bad person I am. I will not answer one that says, I had one recently that I had no right to have Jewish angels in Sally Friedman. because Sally was 10 years old and she thought, fine, why not?
What is the ideal relationship for you with an editor?
I have had the most ideal relationships with editors. I have been the luckiest of writers. I was discovered early on by a man named Dick Jackson, who is just, the best editor anybody could ever have. And then at the same time by Ann Durrell, who led me to write the Fudge books as I wrote them, because I had written a picture book called Peter Fudge and Dribble about the last chapter. It became the last chapter in the book. And that's what it was, a picture book. And Anne took me to lunch. This was so exciting to have lunch with an editor. And she is the one who said, how would you like to write a longer book with these characters? And that's how the series of Fudge came about.
And the Tales of a Fourth Grade Nothing, which is the first Fudge book, has its 40th anniversary this year. Judy Bloom is the author, of course. She's in town for Arts and Letters Live tonight at the First United Methodist Church in Dallas. Judy, it's been such a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. You're wonderful. I would do this every day with you.
Me too. Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Joe Bellotti answers the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast, which you can find at kera.org/think. And our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. If you want to say something about the show or ask a question, you can send that to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.